And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Yvette Meneses-Corporon to the program today. Yvette is an Emmy Award-winning writer, producer, and author. She is currently a senior producer with the syndicated entertainment news program, Extra. She's the author of the international best-selling novel, When the Cypress Whispers, and today we'll be talking about her recent nonfiction book, Something Beautiful Happened, a story of survival and courage in the face of evil, which is published by Howard Books. Yvette, your book opens with a tragedy that hit your family in April of 2014. What kind of evil happened on that spring day?
Tremendous evil happened on that spring day. It was a day that devastated our family, the community, and sort of sent shockwaves across the country and across the globe. On April 13th, my 14-year-old nephew, Reet, was on his way to a singing audition at the JCC in Overland Park, Kansas. His grandfather, Bill, was driving him. Reet had been practicing for months and months for this audition. And before he left the house, his mother, Mindy, my dear friend, asked him to sing to her, to tell her what he was going to sing at the audition. So he sang two songs for her, and the second one was, "You're Gonna Miss Me When I'm Gone." And Reet never came home again. When he got to the JCC, there was a man there. He was a white supremacist neo-Nazi. And he was intent on killing Jews that day. So he went to the JCC thinking that he was going to kill Jews. And he saw my nephew Reet and Bill get out of the car, and he shot them and killed them both. And then he went down the road to a nursing home, and he shot a third person, a woman named Terry Lamano. So this man, this monster, set out to kill Jews that day, and he murdered three people, none of whom were Jewish. And it was devastating. I mean, it's still doesn't seem real. You know, a 14-year-old boy on his way to a singing audition in a beautiful town in Kansas, gone.
And unfortunately, your family knew well before this past year and a half, when we've seen so much of white nationalism and anti-Semitism have a more public face in America, that this was a coming tide.
Yeah, it's quite shocking, actually. You know, this happened 3 years ago in April. And even then, you know, these white supremacists and neo-Nazis were hiding in the shadows. You know, we've always known that they were there, sadly. But I feel like they've been emboldened, and we now have neo-Nazis marching freely in the streets of this country, and they are not hiding in dark chat rooms, and they are not covering their faces, and they are out, and they are waving swastikas. So, you know, sadly, many families have had to deal with this, but now I think it's shocking. It's absolutely shocking to see the level at which they've become emboldened, and the fact that we're still dealing with this, you know, 70-some-odd years, 73, 74 years after the Holocaust, that this is still happening. You know, how and why are families like ours losing loved ones to neo-Nazis? It doesn't make sense to me.
And with the recent marches in Poland that are just huge and horrific.
It's horrifying. In Greece, there's the Golden Dawn party.
Yeah.
Exactly. All across Europe. I'm the daughter of Greek immigrants, and I was at my parents' house a few months ago, and they were watching the Greek satellite news, and I looked up, and I heard Heil Hitler on the TV, and I was like, what movie are you watching? And it was the Greek news. Shocking. Devastating and shocking.
The fact that your family has been affected by this neo-Nazi is ironic, because your family in Greece had worked so hard to hide a Jewish family during the Holocaust.
Yeah, as I say, tragic irony is, you know, not merely reserved for Shakespearean plot twists. The timing especially is just unbelievable. So the story is that 70 years ago, more than 70 years ago in Greece, my grandmother was one of a group of islanders who risked her life to help save a Jewish family from the Nazis. It was the family of a man named Savas Israel. He was a tailor, and he was the tailor to our family. And my grandmother became very friendly with his daughters. And when the Nazis rounded up all the Jews of Corfu, which was the main island off of our tiny island of Erigusa, close to 2,000 Corfiat Jews were sent to their death. Savas and his girls managed to escape, and they made it to our little remote, desolate island. And my grandmother was one of a group of islanders who took them in, protected them, hid them, fed them, clothed them, and saved them and hid them from the Nazis. My father, who was 9 at the time, remembers the Nazis in our house. Actually, in our house, ransacking the house, saying, "Where are the Jews? Where are the Jews?" They threatened to murder my family, any family found hiding Jews. They threatened to burn down the island if they found anyone hiding Jews. And despite this, not one person on the island gave up the secret. Not one person, even those who didn't want them there, because there were people who didn't want them there because they knew it was dangerous and they knew these were not idle threats by the Nazis. But even those who didn't physically work to save this family like my grandmother did, even they were heroic because even they did not give up the secret. Even they did not tell the Nazis that there was a Jewish family hiding on the island. So this entire island worked together to hide and save this Jewish family. I searched for years and years and years to find this family. I grew up listening to my grandmother's stories about, you know, her friends and how much she loved them and what difficult times they were. And often when the young girls would leave their hiding place at night under the cover of darkness and make their way to my grandmother's house, they would knock on the door. My grandmother would let them in. And my father still tells me that sometimes it was the only time that he would see my grandmother smile all day is when the girls, her Jewish friends, came, knocked on the door, and she would let them inside, and they would stay up all night talking and teaching my grandmother how to sew. So in what was a very difficult time, at the height of World War II, at the height of the German occupation, you know, there was something really beautiful that happened on that island. And I listened and I heard this story growing up. And like so many teenagers, I barely paid attention to my grandmother's story. I was like, all right, whatever. And I ran like to go listen to my music or call my friends. But then as an adult, and I'm a journalist, that's what I do for a living. And after I became a mother, I started thinking about my grandmother's story and what she did and what it meant and how she risked her own children's lives to save other, you know, the children of another woman. And I thought about that. And I realized that I really wanted to see if I could make good, you know, after so many years of kind of not paying attention, not asking my grandmother any questions, not digging deeper, I decided to see if I could make good now as an adult and see if I could find this family that she risked her life to save. So I searched and searched for years and years, dead end after dead end. And then finally, with the help of Yad Vashem, which is the Holocaust Museum in Israel, and the genealogy website MyHeritage.com, I finally found this family. I mean, it was truly miraculous that we found them. And when I called to reach out to tell them, I can't believe I found you. I can't believe I found you. I was crying. They were like, what are you talking about? You know, because like so many Holocaust survivors, their mothers never talked about the war. They never knew that my grandmother, an entire island community, risked their lives to save their mothers because the women never talked about it. They never said a word. They didn't talk about the family members that were murdered. So it was incredible and miraculous and just a beautiful, beautiful thing that happened when I finally found this family and filled in their lost history. I found them on April 10th of 2014. 3 days later, April 13th of 2014, is when my nephew and his grandfather were murdered by a neo-Nazi in Kansas. And that, as you mentioned, is just the epitome, right, of tragic irony.
Now, going back to 1944, it was around the time of D-Day when the Nazis replaced the Italians on Corfu and Aracusa. But your family had its own secret that it was hiding and hoping the Nazis wouldn't find out.
Again, as I mentioned, the Nazis literally went door to door on this island. And what the islanders did, they rallied. You know, some took active part in hiding and helping the family, as my grandmother did. A group of my grandmother's friends got together. And they took whatever clothing they had and they gave it to the Jewish family. Remember, he was a tailor. So they were much more well-dressed than the rest of the islanders. My grandmother was uneducated. She was basically, you know, this was a peasant. This was a very primitive, old-school, traditional village type of living. And they had very traditional, very old-school clothing, you know, peasant clothing. And so they took their peasant clothing, the uniform, you know, the scarf on the head and the skirt and the blouse, and they gave these articles of clothing to the Jewish family to wear. This way they blended in. One of the women on the island took the cross from her own neck and gave it to one of the Jewish girls, the eldest daughter named Nina, and said to her, put this on because if the Nazis think that you're Christian, if they don't think that you're Jewish, you'll be saved. You'll be safe. And Nina said to her, I was born a Jew and I will die a Jew. Thank you. But no. And she never renounced her faith. She never put the cross on. So this entire island community, they fed them, they clothed them. There were people starving all across Greece at the time. Hundreds of thousands of people died of starvation. Now, mind you, this was an island. They could fish. They were better off than the rest of Greece. But even so, there was not a lot of food. And my father remembers my grandmother taking food off of his plate to save for her friends at night. The islanders also knew records, right? Keeping records, keeping tabs. The Germans knew that they were Jews missing because they kept census. And they knew when they shipped them to Auschwitz that close to 200 Jews had escaped and were either hiding in the hills or being hidden by Christian families, like what happens on Edikusa. There were records on Edikusa, right? Birth records, marriage records, census documents. The islanders burned all of those records so they wouldn't fall into the Nazi hands. So everyone,
But that made your task later much more difficult.
Oh, that made my task a lot more difficult. But gratefully, the records on the main island of Corfu are intact. I mean, it is a treasure trove that we discovered. Records dating back to the Venetian times. And going into the archives of the beautiful island of Corfu and digging through those archives was extraordinary. And that's where how we were able to sort of bring this family back to life and fill in this lost history for this family and in the bigger picture for the Jewish community of Corfu.
But your family was hiding the fact that your grandfather had already emigrated to America.
Oh, sorry. I'm so sorry. I went off on this long tangent. Yeah. So what happened there, and there I go off on my tangents. That was a lovely lead-in that I didn't get, so I'm sorry. So at the time, yes, you're right. My grandfather had left Greece like so many men at the time did. And he was working in America in the diners, saving money so he can send for his family. And so knowing that the Nazi soldiers, the German soldiers, would not exactly look kindly on an American family because that's how they would have classified us. My grandmother told my father and his sister, from this day on, you're orphans. And my grandmother dressed in black as a widow would. And my father and his sister were like, what are you talking about? We're not orphans. You know, our father's in America. You're here. And my grandmother insisted, no, you are orphans. If the Germans say anything about your father, you say that he died, that you were orphans, because if they learned that he was in America, they would be classified as Americans and they would become targets. So that was yet another layer of secrets that these children, I mean, think about it. My dad was 9, his sister was 7. Could you imagine keeping these life or death secrets at that age? Unbelievable.
So how do you hide a family of 5 on an island that's not even 2 square miles?
Okay, it's a tiny, tiny island, as you said, but truly the entire community worked together. When they first got to the island, they were brought to the priest's house, and the priest willingly gave up his home, called the Keli, and he allowed the family to stay and hide in his home, and that's where they stayed during the day. They really didn't leave much during the day because even though the Germans did not occupy Edikusa 24-7, they would come and go, but still, they were people who didn't want them there. They were people who might turn them in. You never knew. Nothing was safe. Nothing was a sure bet. So they hid during the day in the priest's home. And then at night, when it was dark, they would leave and take a little chance, take a little risk, and go to my grandmother's house and some of their other friends and visit and try to stay hidden. When the Nazis did come, they had sort of a system of warning. You know, the early morning fishermen would get up, you know, to pull their nets, and they would see the German boats approaching, and they would send people out across the island to warn everyone, you know, hide your guns. That was the biggest thing, right? Because they wanted everyone to turn in their guns. Hide your guns, hide your valuables, hide what food you have, and go tell the Jews to hide. And then members of the community would go to the house, go to Savas's hiding place in the priest's home, and they would gather up some supplies, and they would send the family to the other side, the uninhabited side of the island. Hopefully, very little chance of the Germans going to that dark, dangerous, difficult to get to part of the island. And the family would stay there in an old abandoned hut, basically, until it was safe for them to go back to their hiding place in the priest's house.
What were the stories like that your grandmother, your Yaya, shared with you when you were growing up that you were only kind of hearing with one ear?
Well, you know, it's kind of amazing because, you know, to hear the story now, it's unbelievable, right? It's dramatic. It's extraordinary. It's, oh my gosh, this entire island risked their lives. But they knew the danger. They were very well aware of the danger. But after the fact, it was just another story from wartime. So she would tell me that there wasn't very much food to eat. She would tell me that it was very difficult, you know, being on an island during war, raising my father and his sister, and that all the difficulties of life during war as a poor woman with 2 children that you can imagine. And then it was, oh yes, and there was a Jewish family that we hid and helped save. And then it was on to the next thing. It was just another story, no more significant than any other. And maybe that was part of the reason. It was never told in a very dramatic fashion. It was never shouted from the rooftops. She never spent that much time talking about it. It was just sort of common knowledge. Yeah, there was a Jewish family. We helped them. They survived, and the Germans left, the Nazis left, and life went on. So I guess I didn't have perhaps the life experience, right, as a child, as a teenager, to put 2 and 2 together to really take it to the next level and figure out, well, what does this mean? What does this mean? And it wasn't until I became a parent myself until I held my children in my arms that I really thought about what my grandmother risked and what she did. So throughout my childhood, it was truly like, oh, we're having dinner. Grandma made you soup. Pass the feta. We saved the Jews. It was like no big deal. I even went to Israel. I studied in Israel as a journalism student in college. And I went to Yad Vashem. I went to the Holocaust Museum. And I went to the Garden of the Righteous. And I walked through the Garden of the Righteous where beautiful trees are planted to honor Christians who risked their lives to save their Jewish friends and neighbors. I saw Schindler's tree. I saw all the trees. And I remember being so emotional and thinking, wow, what extraordinary people. And even then, I never put two and two together and thought about my grandmother's story. It wasn't until years later. So I think it was a combination of youth, lack of experience, right? With age comes depth of understanding. And the fact that it was just like, oh, yeah, this happened. And we moved on.
But not many people in Erekusa seem to have thought it was a major story to be passed down. You found quite a bit of ignorance of that history on the island.
Exactly. I mean, I like to say my grandmother had a big mouth. Clearly, I inherited it because we're the ones who talk. But so many people on the island, you know, of course, clearly her generation knew. Clearly, my father's generation knew because they lived it. But when I started digging around and asking questions and at first trying to see, okay, well, it was a challenge to myself. Can I find this family? Let's put my investigative journalism skills to test. Can I really do this? And so I started digging around and searching, and I was really surprised to learn that so many people of my generation, the grandchildren of the people who saved this family, didn't even know the story. Some of them never even knew that there was a Jewish family on the island. They never knew that their grandparents knew them, had helped. They never knew that this was a collective story of resistance and defiance during World War II. An incredible story. Some people had no idea. And that really surprised me. But I think that speaks to that generation because there was such trauma that this generation survived. So many people were told, don't look back, look forward, forget the past, forget what happened during the war. It wasn't just the survivors. It was so many people in that generation who witnessed it, who maybe were not targets of the Nazis themselves, but who witnessed what happened to their friends and to their neighbors, and who were perhaps faced with speak up and help someone, risk your life to help them, or do you stay quiet? And I think that that lent to an entire generation where so many people never shared their stories. And that was one of the reasons why I really wanted to write this book, Something Beautiful Happened, is sort of the urgency of it all, is that every day we're getting closer to losing this generation, the ones who never spoke of what happened during World War II. And I felt an obligation to find out more and to document this story. And it makes me so happy and so proud that people are reading this book and are inspired to do the same and are searching for the hidden stories in their own homes and family history.
And you talked about how when you were young, of course, listening with just the one ear to your grandmother, but also that you didn't care much for the traditional Greek food that was prepared at the time. But when you made your first trip back to the homeland, then your love for the culture really flowered.
Yeah, it's like, as I say, it's like cultural osmosis. You know, I grew up in a very traditional Greek home. I wanted, you know, peanut butter fluff sandwiches, and I wanted Rice Krispie treats. And I wanted a grandmother who, like, you know, spent her summers in Miami and had her hair done. And I didn't. You know, my yaya made fish head soup. And we did not summer in Miami. She didn't take me shopping at Bloomingdale's. You know, she spoke Greek and wore black. And we did not have that experience. And so there was a part of me, while I've always loved the rich culture that our family comes from, I've always been very proud of where we come from. But there was a part of me, you know, as a kid who just wanted to be like everybody else. And we were so not like everybody else. I mean, we were not, you know, we spoke a different language. We ate different foods. All my friends went to Hebrew school. I had to go to Greek school. It was very, very different culturally. And my mother and grandmother would always try to get me to, like, come and cook with them. Again, I would run in the other direction. And then when I went out on my own, when I got my first apartment, when I went to Greece for the first time, I found myself gravitating to the foods, the smells, the music, anything that identified culturally with Greece. There was like a cultural osmosis had taken place. And when I started cooking for myself, I started cooking like my grandmother and my mother, even though I could never stand to stay and do it when they asked me to. I guess I was learning all along. And even now in my own home, it's the same. I cook very traditional Greek food. I'm the overbearing, you know, Greek mother, definitely, who plies everyone with food every time, you know, when they walk into the house, who insists my children speak Greek. And again, I think hindsight is 20/20. You know, when you come from a rich cultural upbringing, sometimes you can't appreciate it when you're in the moment, and it takes a few years to sort of understand what that is and how important it is and how special.
In the book, you write so lovingly and glowingly about Erekusa. Are you worried that it might become a tourist destination that gets overrun by?
You know, it's really funny because this conversation comes up all the time. You know, it's much more built up now than it was when I was a kid. You know, my mode of transportation when I was a kid was truly like a donkey that I would ride to the beach. And now dirt roads are paved over. There are a handful of cars. There is a hotel. There are actually two hotels. They're building a large hotel. So I think we strive for a balance. We want the world to know the incredible thing that happened there, and we want the island to be recognized and honored as it should be. But we want just the right amount of tourists, you know? So the economy is booming. Everyone is happy. People can appreciate our beautiful island. But as much as I want to see progress, there's a part of me that always just wants to keep that beautiful little gem to ourselves that it has for generations. One of my all-time favorite things was the summer after the book came out, we were able to go to Greece, to Erekusa, with the families that I found, with the descendants, the children and the grandchildren of the Jewish girls that my grandmother saved. We all went to Greece together. There was a beautiful ceremony to honor the island, and the family got to meet some of the rescuers who were still alive. I mean, it was incredibly moving and emotional. And as I was preparing for that trip, my husband and I went ahead, and we were walking near my grandmother's house, and we met a woman and started chatting, and, you know, oh, how did you hear about Erekusa? She said, well, you know, I read this book about the island, and I had to come, and I had written, before I wrote Something Beautiful Happened, I had written a novel called When the Cypress Whispers, and that was a fictionalized account of my grandmother's life. And in it, she too, the grandmother, also saves the family from the Jews. So that was my fictional telling of my grandmother's story. And people from around the world started reading this book. It was translated into 14 languages and Googling and realizing, hey, there really is an Erekusa, and taking trips. So when I was there, I bumped into this woman who had read it in Norway, made the pilgrimage to Erekusa, and I was able to take her on a private tour. I took her to my grandmother's house and showed her where everything happened, you know, to the cemetery, to everything. So it's really nice that in these difficult economic times, people are reading both of my books and are coming to Greece, are coming to Corfu, are rediscovering, you know, this beautiful paradise, but just the right amount. We don't want it overrun with tourists.
So how was it like writing about your family openly and in a nonfiction way, as opposed to having a veiled way in the fictional writing?
I mean, talk about the weight of the world. I felt such tremendous responsibility in writing this book. You know, fiction's awesome because when someone doesn't like something that I write, I could just say, well, I made it up. You know, when someone says, well, why did you end it that way? I'm like, because I wanted to. It's mine. It's my imagination. Nonfiction's altogether a different animal, especially a nonfiction book like this. And, you know, something beautiful did indeed happen on that island in that time. This family was saved, but so many people were not saved. This entire community, the Jewish community of Corfu, they were about, you know, 2,000 in this community, and 1,800 of them were murdered at Auschwitz. So I felt a tremendous responsibility, not just to my immediate family and to the family of Savas Israel and his daughters, and little Rosa, who was a little girl who was saved and hidden with them. I felt a tremendous responsibility to the entire community, this community who was lost. And the survivors today feel forgotten by history. I've interviewed them, I've met with them, and trying to gather more information about my story and the intimate details of this family, Savas Israel's family, I have been so fortunate to get to know some of the survivors of the Jewish community of Corfu. And the resounding theme again and again is that they feel like history has forgotten them. When they came back from Auschwitz, they were told, look forward, don't look back. Forget the families that you lost. Forget your husbands, wives, siblings, parents. Marry amongst yourselves and start fresh. How do you do that? How do you just forget generations before you? So I felt a tremendous responsibility to my family, to the Jewish community of Corfu, to the survivors who I'm now honored and so blessed to call my friends, and also to my family in Kansas. You know, Reet was 14 years old. He should be here. living his life, telling his story. But he's not. He was taken away from us. And so I feel a tremendous responsibility to tell his story and his grandfather's story and Mindy, his mother, Reet's mother, because her story is extraordinary. You know, this is a woman who lost both her father and her son in one day. Her father and son were murdered in one afternoon. And she, instead of curling up into a ball in the corner, which is probably what so many of us, probably what I would have done, she instead, the very first moment when they told her, I'm sorry, your son hasn't made it, the very first words out of her mouth were, something good has to come from this. And she has.
Could you tell us about 7 days?
Yes,
make
of
a ripple?
Course. So Give 7 Days, Make a Ripple, Change the World is what my cousin Mindy Corporon has put forth in memory of her son Reet and her dad Bill, who were murdered by the neo-Nazi, as we said before. The day that they were murdered, as I said, she said, I want something good to come from this. And immediately, she knew that she had to do something to make sure that Bill and Reet were remembered by history, not as victims of a hate crime, because that's not who they were, but as catalysts of change and as vehicles of putting love in the world, right? Love overcoming hate. So she launched a foundation. She and the entire family have launched a foundation called Give 7 Days. And Mindy now dedicates herself to promoting interfaith awareness through speaking engagements, through events, through promoting acts of kindness. She is all about promoting interfaith awareness because she understands that the more we learn about one another, the more you remove the stigma, the fear, the ignorance, that's where the hate is rooted. So she wants to promote acts of kindness and put goodness in the world. And because of this and because of her initiative, Bill and Reet will be known to history as catalysts for change and of good.
Now, we're taping this in mid-November, and I just saw yesterday that the documentary Big Sonia is debuting tomorrow nationwide. Tell us about how you got to meet Sonia Warshawski.
Sonia Warshawski is a rock star. She is an extraordinary woman. I was in Kansas with Mindy for Give 7 Days, and Mindy featured Sonia's story in her event. Give 7 Days, Make a Ripple, Change the World is, as I said, about putting forth acts of kindness in the world. And Mindy interviewed Sonia, and she profiled her as a woman who has overcome, you know, tremendous, tremendous obstacles. Sonia's entire family was murdered. She survived the concentration camps, and she moved to Kansas. And she stayed quiet like so many other survivors. She did not speak of what happened to her for years until she watched on television someone went on TV and claimed that the Holocaust never existed. And she knew in that moment she had to stand up and always speak out and tell her story, tell people that it's real and we can't allow this to happen again. So I got to meet Sonia when I was in Kansas. Her granddaughter, Leah Warshawski, is a filmmaker and has made the most extraordinary documentary called Big Sonia. Now, Sonia is teeny tiny. She's like 4'8". But if you ever meet her, you know that she's not only Big Sonia, she's larger than life Sonia. So Big Sonia is the documentary about Sonia Warshawski's life and how she overcame such tremendous evil to put forth goodness in the world. And she's a powerhouse. And she's one of the people that I interviewed in writing Something Beautiful Happened and, you know, sharing her perspective with me and with Mindy was life-changing for all of us. And I encourage everyone to go see Big Sonia because it's an extraordinary film.
The poster is remarkable because you think of a Holocaust survivor. You don't think of a woman with a leopard print steering wheel.
And her lipstick.
Yeah.
And her lipstick. I mean, she's just awesome. And she's a tailor as well, so she's always immaculately turned out.
This process of researching and getting all the information and writing the book, going through these very difficult human tragedies that your family has suffered, are you able to move on to another writing project, or do you have to live with this one a little bit longer?
That's an interesting question because I'm wrestling with this as we speak, trying to figure out what my next book is going to be. You know, I started in fiction, and I thought that that's where I would live. And then my editor came to me and said, put down the fiction. You need to write this book. This is the book you need to write. And I was struggling with it of like, I thought perhaps I needed to write this story, but I was so overcome with the weight of it all and the responsibility of telling these stories. Was I up to it? Was it my story to tell? And I did, and I'm so glad that I did, and I'm so very proud of this book. But now it's the question of what next. So there are a couple of things that we're considering. One is a continuation of this theme of searching for the history in our homes because, you know, this is my family story, but every family has a story. I hope your family story is not as dramatic as my family story, but every family has a story, and there is history, real incredible history hidden in our homes and in these old photo albums, right? So I'm kind of now considering staying in this vein and exploring more of seeking and finding and helping people document the histories in their own home. So we'll see. But it's right now, I'm just glad this book got done because there were times I wasn't so sure that it would ever be done.
Has any additional history and information come to you since the publication of the book that it was too late to get in?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Not so much on this story, not so much on the community of Corfu and the survivors there. I mean, the family tree continues to grow. I work very closely with the genealogy website, myheritage.com, and they were extraordinary. And they took me under their wing and they said, okay, we're going to help you. And they did. They really, truly, they're the ones who found this family.
A couple of chapters of this book were almost a commercial. They were so good.
But it happened. It's organic. I mean, these guys just went above and beyond to try to find this family. They're an Israeli-based company. And they do a lot of pro bono work. They have 90 million users around the world. And every now and then, they'll hear a story that just speaks to them. And they say, no, we're going to move heaven and earth to help you. And I was fortunate enough to be one of those stories. And because of what they experienced with our family and the incredible ripple effects of finding this family my grandmother saved, they now have not given up. They've gone in. And they have completely rebuilt the history of the Jewish community of Corfu, which, as I said before, was lost to history. And because of that, they've reunited Holocaust survivors with families they never knew existed. So that continues to happen. The family tree still continues to grow. And I was on TV. I did a segment on Fox and Friends, actually, talking about this book. And a woman was watching my segment and was inspired to see if she could find her family. So she went through the whole thing. She did MyHeritage. She took a MyHeritage DNA test. She had been looking for her biological family for years and years. She couldn't find them. And because she saw my segment and heard about my story, she found her biological mother.
Oh, wow.
So she did the DNA test. And then within a matter of weeks, she got the results. And within an hour and a half, she was on the phone with her biological mother that she had been searching for more than 60 years. Her mother was still alive. Hmm. So the ripple effects of this story are just, you know, they keep kind of fanning out.
Well, we'll see how many people can join the ripple after they hear our interview today.
Excellent. I hope so. Join in.
Well, Yvette, I want to thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us today, and it's really been a pleasure having you on.
Oh, thank you so much. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yvette Meneses-Corporon is the author of Something Beautiful Happened, a story of survival and courage in the face of evil, which is published by Howard Books. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.